It's Tuesday, the 3rd of September, and this is the Monocle Minute. Today, details of a planned prisoner swap between Russia and Ukraine remain elusive. Now, there are suggestions that a suspect wanted over the downing of flight MH17 could be the reason the deal was called off.
He's believed to be the only available witness for actually establishing a direct link between Russian military forces and the downing of the airplane.
Plus, a boost for Germany's far right in regional elections. Could Disney bring about the end of binge-watching? And Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck reconsiders the design value of elevated walkways. I'm Ben Rylan in London. The Monocle Minute starts now. A long-awaited exchange of prisoners between Russia and Ukraine stalled last week, despite reports that it was underway. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky urged those spreading misinformation to consider the consequences and to stop playing with people's emotions. However, there's now growing speculation that a suspect wanted in connection with the downing of flight MH17 over Ukraine in 2014 might be the reason the exchange was called off. I'm joined on the line by Maxim Eristavi, Research Fellow with the Atlantic Council and co-founder of the Hromadsky International News Network. Max, this is a sensitive situation and one could understand a want for secrecy. However, there have also been quite a few false reports being spread here.
The biggest problem with this exchange is lack of transparency. And I do get that any talks about the hostage situation, they sometimes won't benefit from a lot of transparency. However, in this case, I think that's the main problem, and it's something that impedes them, is the lack of information the Ukrainian public and the international community have about this. Russia and the Kremlin even designed a disinformation campaign trying to push Ukrainian officials for an exchange, and specifically to exchange a key MH17 witness. There are no information official whatsoever about whether the new Ukrainian leadership agreed to it or put that name on the exchange list. However, it is probably the most likely reason why the exchange kind of, if not collapsed, then definitely stalled at the moment.
The suspect you're referring to, Max, his name is Volodymyr Tsemakh. His picture has been featured across Ukrainian media this week. Can you tell us, who is Volodymyr Tsemakh?
Well, basically, Volodymyr Tsemakh is a key witness in the downing of passenger airplane MH17. The Ukrainian security service extracted that person from Russian occupying territories some time ago. Tsemakh is a Ukrainian citizen. However, he was fighting on the side of Russian forces and Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. And he's believed to be the only available witness for actually establishing a direct link between Russian military forces and the downing of the airplane.
Well, we know that Tsemakh is qualified to fire the kind of missile that downed that Malaysia Airlines flight. Now, unsurprisingly, there are those who say that he had nothing to do with any of this. Nevertheless, he was arrested on the 27th of June this year. Max, what do we know about whether Volodymyr Tsemakh was involved in the attack on MH17?
Look, I don't want to speculate, and I don't think we should speculate, since there was no trial whatsoever, and all we know about this person is kind of fragmented information. Ideally, there is a pending trial back in Netherlands starting this March, where his testimony could be crucial and where he would be called as a witness or a person of interest. There has been no trial in Ukraine yet whatsoever. Therefore, the only thing we do know that he is for now the only and the key witness in the investigating of MH17 downing and the role of Russian military forces in that downing. But apart from that, no details, no confirmed details exist.
So it is fair to say that speculation on his personal involvement would at this stage not be helpful. But Max, the suggestion here is that Tsemakh's presence on this list of prisoners to be exchanged with Russia is what led to this deal being called off. Do we know if there's any clear link between Cermak and this prisoner swap?
Well, we don't, because, again, because of lack of transparency from the Ukrainian side about these negotiations, kind of raised the biggest question of them all. And I think that this question relates to foreign policy and diplomatic qualifications of new Ukrainian leadership. If we were have more transparency or more experienced diplomats were dealing with the process, I think those issues might have been avoided from the start, but here we are.
It's an intriguing story. We'll continue following the developments, of course. Maxim Eristavi, always appreciate your insights. Thank you. To Germany now, where the far right has performed strongly in regional elections in the east of the country, taking up to 27% of the vote. Stephanie Boltzen from Die Welt explains why Germans should be concerned about what the election results could mean for the country's political future.
Certainly we should be concerned because it's something that has been predicted for a long time that the Alternative für Deutschland, the so-called AfD, which is a right-wing, anti-immigrant, partly anti-European Union party, would be surging, especially in the east of Germany. And we have seen that on Sunday again. But it's also important to say that there was a fear from the established parties that they could even win the election in Saxony, and they haven't. Actually, the CDU, Angela Merkel's party, has clearly won this election, but there is no reason for the traditional parties to be complacent. It's still a lot about migration. It is also still quite a protest vote. People in East Germany feel that they have been not as well regarded and appreciated ever since the wall came down in 1989. And also there is a different culture. It's a part of Germany that is still more sympathy for Russia. It's a part of Germany where, say, authoritarian ideas maybe find a little bit more of support. If you look at the economic data, it's actually not bad. I mean, there is not a very high unemployment. People are having pretty good living standards, but there is this very widespread feeling of frustration of being not as valued as people in the West. And especially with the immigrants coming in, a lot of people have expressed anger because they feel that immigrants, quote, come in, get everything they want while we have been working hard and do never get what we actually would like to have in our life.
Finally today, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck considers why, sometimes when searching for the perfect urban planning solution, one need only look up.
I first read about it in Monocle, actually, so I thought it was about time that I took myself off to see the project. So, on a sunny morning, I cycled into the City of London to see a scheme that reimagines the elevated walkway and a lot more besides. London Wall Place is an office development inserted into a plot that also includes the remains of the medieval St. Alphege Church and a section of the original Roman London Wall. In the endless cycle of redevelopment in the City of London, there's nothing intrinsically exciting about any of these facts. But go visit, because there are lots of impressive quality benchmarking details, not least that the scheme literally works on so many levels. In numerous post-war architecture projects, the elevated walkway, or pedway, was the go-to solution for cities that imagined the street would become the domain of the car. In places such as London, however, they were often poorly maintained, rain-swept, badly lit, and soon associated with all sorts of nefarious activities. People certainly didn't like using them at night. But at London Wall Place, they have a surprisingly beautiful new reincarnation. Linking the site with neighbours, such as the brutalist Barbican Centre, they're made from rust-red steel and with you-want-to-touch-me-smooth wooden handrails. There are walkways that cling to the sides of buildings, others that weave with a snaky, sinuous confidence. And when you climb up onto them, well, it's pleasing. You walk above the traffic, the ruins, the planting. Oh yes, the planting, that's glorious too. There is greenery spilling over handrails, banks of quivering grasses, sunken spots to sit and think, or at least have a Pret sandwich. It's stunning. The planners say that there are 45,000 square feet of new green space. In metric, it's quite big. But it's the pedways that charm and allure. It's the fresh angle that you view your city from. That new perspective. It's so reviving.
Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck. And for more urbanism stories, catch our weekly program, The Urbanist, Thursdays on Monocle 24. Well, that's all for today's program. You can read and subscribe to our daily email bulletin at our website, monocle.com. I'm Ben Rylan. The Monocle Minute returns on Wednesday.